And we're joined with space historian Robert Zimmerman. I love talking about space, and we're going to do that tonight on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Robert Zimmerman joining us, award-winning science journalist, historian. He has written a number of books and numerous articles on science, engineering, the history of space exploration and technology. Some include Genesis, The Universe in a Mirror, Leaving Earth, the Chronological Encyclopedia of Discoveries in Space. His website is BehindTheBlack.com. And, of course, he also reports on space and science news at his website, BehindTheBlack.com. Robert, welcome back, my friend. How have you been?
I'm in good, George. It's always a pleasure to be here. You know, it's been too long.
It has been a while since we talked. They're talking more about the Space Force. Congress has passed laws. The Senate's passed laws. We're going to get funding for it. What do you think of that?
You know, it's interesting about the Space Force. That was, everyone makes a big deal about how, oh my gosh, Trump wants to have people in uniform with guns in space firing lasers and phasers. The real reason he proposed that was to get the military space bureaucracy reorganized. The military has been trying to get this to happen for about 10 years. It was spread over many different agencies. It did not have a voice in the Washington bureaucracy. The Air Force ran it mostly, and they have their own interests that are separate from space. And so there's been an effort in the Pentagon to get it reorganized, and they couldn't get it off the ground. And Trump, being very clever about these things, announced we're going to have a space force, and of course that gets a lot of press and
mm-hmm.
discussion. And the result is that they got the thing off the ground. And so what's really happened here is that bureaucracy's now been reorganized. Now, I don't know if in the long run this is going to work, because Washington bureaucracies tend to grow and not save you any money and don't necessarily make things more efficient. But the concept, the idea, was to make things more efficient and to give that the needs of the nation in terms of military space a focus. And so we will see if that transpires over the next few years. But at least is where I see it coming, and I think the concept was a good one. We'll see once again how it plays out.
Well, if we don't do it, another nation will, Robert.
Well, yeah, you know, what's the fact is that the Chinese, who are an undeniable threat to the United States, are trying very hard to become the next superpower. They want to literally replace the Soviet Union in the world competition for power. And they are, part of the way they're doing that is to have a very aggressive and well-planned space program. And it is a military program. Anyone who thinks otherwise is not paying attention. Their military runs the entire operation, and that's what their goals are. Anything they do in space is specifically, even if it's a civilian effort, a manned civilian effort, it's a scientific probe to the far side of the moon, a rover there. All the technology that they develop there is fed right back into their military-industrial complex. And so they are something to pay attention to. They, in a sense, already have their space force. One of the things a lot of Americans don't know about China, to talk about this, is that they have been using their space industry as a training program for their political leadership. So their provincial governors, same as our state governors, they're not elected; they're appointed. This is very Confucian in concept. They have a management arrangement how they run their country, as they have for thousands of years. In the past, they used to have this test where you had to take a literature test in Chinese, and anyone could take it, no matter how poor you were. And if you succeeded in passing, you would, in line, in the track, to become a major, important, powerful bureaucrat or manager or even leader within the Chinese government. That's for thousands of years. Well, it didn't really work. It got corrupted. You know, passing a test on literature doesn't necessarily make you a good manager politically, especially when you start to have to compete against technological countries from the West. and they collapsed in the 19th century. They couldn't compete. And so they now instead use their space program as that test. And of their provincial governors, about half came out of the space management, the management of their space program. And they, so their governors that rule their provinces came out of their space program. It would be like in the United States, you want to become a governor of New York State or California, you've got to be a successful manager at NASA and have successfully run a program there. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that approach, but what it means twofold in China is they have found a way to develop a effective management system in their government in the modern technological world. That's one, and that makes them a definitive threat, or at least competitor with us. And the second thing is it means that their space program is going to be treated favorably by their government because so many people came out of it. And you don't go into a space program without a little bit of geek space cadet in you. And so so that's twofold what to think about. And those same people are going to see, are going to favor, keep using their space program as a way to keep feeding good people into their governmental management structure. And so that means they are going to be a space force, and I'm not using it in terms of the Trump ads, but they're going to be a force in space that will have to be contended with for probably a very long time.
What do you think of the privatization of space? I mean, we've got all these companies popping up already, you know, launching, and what's your take on that?
Well, let's use a little history. I'm a historian, so let's look at history over the last half century. When in the, and this is what Genesis, my book Genesis, Story of Apollo 8, basically talked about, how we won the space race in the 60s, but it taught us all the wrong lessons. We won that space race to prove that freedom, private enterprise, capitalism, and competition are the way to make a great society and to achieve great things. But to win the space race, we built it on a space program, a Soviet model. And the lesson the nation took from that is let's have more space programs, let's have big government, let's become the Soviet Union. Literally, that's what became. And so for the last 50 years, we have not done very much in space. We really didn't accomplish very much. Government doesn't achieve these things very well. They're not capable of it. And what's most interesting is how quickly, when you allow private enterprise to be your king here, to make things work, you suddenly get incredible innovation, and you disrupt the industry, and you suddenly get things happening that for years were not happening. And the prime example, I always talk about this, and I've talked about this on your show before, but it bears repeating, is that for 50 years, and I've been a historian on this subject for decades, and I've been following space since I was a teenager in the 60s, for decades, managers and engineers at all the major rocket companies repeatedly told, said, and they told me personally repeatedly as a journalist, that it is impossible to reuse any part of your rocket. You can't land it vertically. You can't, even if you could, you'd waste so much fuel you couldn't get your payload into orbit. And even if you have successfully landed and gotten your payload into orbit, the first stage is just not going to be in a usable state to launch again.
How wrong could they be, right?
They couldn't be farther wrong. And the reason it happened is that SpaceX is being run by a private individual who had dreams of his own and decided to take risks and innovate and not accept that accepted wisdom. And because he saw a way to make a lot of money. He saw that if he could reduce the cost of launch, he would pull in a lot of business that others weren't trying to get. And the fact is that SpaceX and Elon Musk in the last decade has literally stolen the entire market share of rocket launches that Russia had, about a third of what Europe had, and I'd say about 20% of what the other American launch companies had.
Isn't that dramatic?
And the result is he's making a very lot of money. Money that he keeps for himself, he should, but most of which he pumps back into the company to do more innovation, to keep himself ahead of the game. I'll give you an example. This week, they made their first launch for the year. And when they did, they launched 60 new satellites in their Starlink constellation. This is SpaceX trying to do a constellation to provide worldwide internet capabilities. And now they've already put up 180 satellites of that, and within less than a year, they've leapfrogged every other satellite communications constellation company in the world, and they now have the biggest constellation. It's only begun. They're going to put a lot more satellites up before the year's over. But their goal is to provide internet services for the world at a cheap cost. And they're using the Falcon 9 rocket to launch it. And, all right, so SpaceX has the satellites, and they now have the rocket. That rocket, the first stage of the rocket that they launched, this was the fourth time they'd used it. You realize how
much? That's amazing.
When they have another customer, they reduce the cost, but they don't have to bring the cost down a lot because no one else can match them. So they make a lot of profit when they've got other customers. But when it's their own payload going into orbit, that's a lot of money they're saving, which means when they get their constellation launched, they'll be able to provide that worldwide internet service almost certainly at a price much less than any other satellite constellation, and there are others trying to do the same thing. And so this, you see how this builds upon itself, and so competition and private enterprise creates innovation and reduces the cost for everybody. And so this is what, you know, we're back in the Cold War. You've got a Chinese space program, centralized, run by the government, competing now with the American concept of competition, freedom, and private enterprise. I'll put my money on the private enterprise thing any day of the week, but it's the same Cold War as before, and we have to fight it. We have to be aware of it.
What would you say, Robert, has been, over the last few years, the most dramatic thing you've seen for space?
Well, it depends on whether you're talking about the science and the actual exploration going on, or if you're talking about commercial space and the ability to get into space better. I mean, to me, probably the most exciting, in terms of rocketry and getting into space, the most exciting moment in the last, oh, I would say 40 years since the landing on the moon. Well, maybe there's other things in between, but one of the most earth-shattering, exciting moments was when SpaceX successfully landed its first stage for the very first time. Because, once again, I had been hearing that this was impossible for decades. And what can I say? I'm not an engineer. I got to accept on face value what people were telling me, but they said they were going to do it. And when I was at the speech where Elon Musk announced he was going to try to do this, and I said, gee, everyone told me that wasn't going to work. He made it work. And then they proceeded to reuse the first stages. And then they proceeded to land it on a barge out in the ocean. And I said, oh, my gosh. And this is earth-shattering because it changes how you look at rockets. We're no longer looking, and this gets back to the first stage of the Falcon 9 launch this week. They had used that stage four times. It is no longer a rocket that's expendable. It's a ship. It's a ship that's being reused like an airplane. Now, it's not yet at the stage of airplanes where they can fly, you know, millions of miles and last for 40 years in endless flights, but it's getting very close. In fact, SpaceX has two different first stages right now that they've launched four times, and they're going to use again. So that's eight launches where they didn't have to build a new first stage with new engines. They could reuse those engines. Once again, the savings and cost is gigantic. Another way to look at it is they have developed technology that makes it possible to reuse the first stage entirely. They are trying to develop a technology to reuse the fairings that protect the payloads during launch, and they've had some success with that. Those two combined is about 70% of their rocket. What's the remaining 30%? Well, that's the upper stage that gets into orbit. They right now have to discard that first stage, that second stage. Well, you know, when you look at it, the space shuttle essentially recovered its upper stage. That was the shuttle itself.
Mm-hmm.
So the technology exists to recover for a second stage as well. And so what is SpaceX doing? They are developing Starship and Super Heavy, which is their next generation rocket. The first stage, the Super Heavy, is much bigger than the Falcon 9 first stage, but it's essentially using the same technology that they have and they know how to do. So they'll be able to make that first stage, Super Heavy, work. I have no doubt about it because they have the knowledge and the technology. And in fact, they've already done a launch, test flight with the engines for that to show that they can control it and bring it back vertically and land it. The second stage of Starship Super Heavy, Starship, is a reusable ship, basically taking advantage of the knowledge that we have from the space shuttle and applying their engines to it and their ability to land vertically, and they're going to be able to have a reusable second stage. And the two combined will cost per launch, if Elon Musk's predictions are right, and he's been pretty good, if his predictions are right, the launch cost will be comparable to what you pay now for like a Falcon Heavy launch, about $100 million.
Wow.
Reusable. And it'll be putting into orbit equivalent to a Saturn V rocket, 100-plus tons.
When do we go back to the moon or Mars with astronauts?
Well, you see, now that's the interesting question. This is what his company is developing. This ties right into what I'm just saying now, George. So his company is developing this, and they're hoping to start to launch this within the next 3 to 5 years. Meanwhile, for the last 20 years, NASA's been trying to develop its version of a new Saturn V rocket called the Space Launch System. I've written about this. They're going to end up spending close to $60 billion to develop it. It maybe could launch once every year. Each launch is going to cost, depending on how you want to amortize the development costs, anywhere from $2 to $14 billion. They've spent 20 years developing it. They're still 3 years away from launching. This is the rocket that the Trump administration is depending on to get back to the moon by 2024 during his second term, assuming he wins. It is, to my mind, highly unlikely that will happen. If it does happen, it doesn't really get us very much because the cost of the rocket and the cumbersome nature in which it's designed makes it very difficult to really have a long-term space effort. All you'll do is what we did in the 60s. You'll do a stunt launch or two, and that'll be it. So maybe they'll get back to the moon with that, with people on a mission or by 2024, thereabouts. But that's not getting us to the moon. I think what needs to happen to get to the moon is exactly what SpaceX is doing, private enterprise competing to come up with good ideas. And I think that SpaceX will probably be able to achieve that based on their track record. You know, things cannot go wrong, but based on their track record, I think they could probably do it almost as fast, and they'll be doing it with something that will cost pennies in comparison.
When was the last manned moon launch?
That was in 1973.
73.
That was Apollo.
So if we had continued, if we had continued and not stopped then in 73, what would the moon look like now? Would we have bases there and everything else?
You know, it's a difficult question to answer because the assumption has to be that Americans would have been willing to spend the money with the Saturn V rocket to launch many missions. And even though Wernher von Braun designed that rocket as a vehicle for colonizing the entire solar system, and it had the capability because it could put 100 tons into orbit, much like SLS is trying to do and much like Starship is trying to do, it cost a lot. It cost too much. And since Americans have always looked with skepticism on the idea of using government-coerced tax dollars mm-hmm. to do this, the political will was just not there. If the political will had been there, maybe we would have gotten a lot done. We would have had bases on the moon. But I don't think it's realistic.
All right, hold on, Robert. We're at the break. We'll come back for more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. George Norrie back with you, along with Robert Zimmerman. Robert, is it true that the United Arab Emirates are getting involved in space?
Yes, it is. They have.
My gosh.
They had their first astronaut fly in space this year. He was launched on a Russian Soyuz and spent a week on ISS. And that was, you know, they said they had a competition for all their citizens. About 1,000 people applied. But this is a very political place, and so I'm sure it was somebody who got picked who was related or, you know, very close to the powers that be. Nonetheless, they did it. They have established a space agency about 3 years ago. About 3 years ago, they also announced that they were going to have they wanted to fly a mission, an unmanned orbiter probe to Mars. And they have teamed up with India, who has already done such a thing, and Japan as their launch vehicle to build such a thing. And so the whole goal that they've stated is to diversify their economy, to get away from depending entirely on oil, to have their nation and the people in their nation have skills that are future-oriented and highly technical. And so that's their goal. They actually have outlined a 100-year plan for having colonies on Mars built by the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, within that time frame. Now, will any of this happen? I can't tell you. I do know that they have scheduled their probe, their orbiter for Mars. It's titled HOPE. That's at least the translation of the Arabic word. It's scheduled for launch at the next launch window this coming summer, 2020, which is going to be a very busy time for probes going to Mars, because not only is the UAE got its probe, you've got a European rover, Rosalind Franklin, you've got another American rover still unnamed. We call it Mars 2020. It's basically a upgrade of Curiosity. And those two are going, and so you're going to have a lot of missions going to Mars in this coming summer.
Now, what about India?
Now, you see, India is really an interesting case. India is very much trying to catch up to China in its space program. And it is a program. It isn't commercial like in the United States, but it is commercial in concept. It's really interesting way they're approaching this. What happened with China, with India, is they were trying to be a socialist, communist command economy for most of their history in the 20th century.
And it didn't work.
Was they were a very poor country.
Yeah, it didn't work. It
didn't work. So late in the 1990s, they threw the bums out, and they vote. They are a democracy, and they voted new people in, and the government shifted and became capitalist-oriented, and so they're very suddenly they're prosperous. And when you're prosperous, what that means is that your government gets a lot of tax money without even taxing people very much. And so their government has lots of money, and now it has lots of technology and good education. And so what they've been using that for is they're trying to turn their space agency into a commercial national operation. They have two launch vehicles, and they're building the third rocket that's going to go for small satellites. And their goal with those rockets the last decade and a half is to capture commercial market share in the commercial international launch rocket satellite industry. And they've been somewhat successful. At the same time, in the last 5 years, they have, a little more than that, but more increasingly in the last 5 years, they have decided to, at the same time, use the talents that they're developing to create a space program, planetary program, to send probes to other planets. And they had sent probes, they had sent orbiter to the moon. And then last year they tried to land a rover on the moon, and that failed very close to the surface. They got the probe into orbit around the moon, and the orbiter is still working and functioning, but the lander crashed. And they immediately said, well, you know what, we're not going to let this defeat us. And they have now gotten funding, and they have put together a program to launch a second rover and lander in November of 2020. In other words, within a year, they want to repeat it. They already know what to build. They know what went wrong, and so they got very close to landing. They got within just a couple of hundred yards from the surface, so they're close. So they're going to try it again. At the same time, they have now approved a program to have their own first manned mission. They have a rocket. Their largest rocket is capable of putting enough payload in orbit to put a manned capsule. And so they're planning a manned mission before 2022 that would be up for about a week and demonstrate that they can do the same thing. And that
Amazing.
Means that they are trying to become the fourth nation after U.S., Russia, and China to be able to put people in space with their own homegrown equipment. They are definitely a factor in the future. And it's interesting because they are prosperous because they went capitalist and free enterprise. I'll go with that any day. And so they because they're near China, they wish to be able to compete with China because they see China as a direct competitor and a potential threat. And so they need to be able to match them step by step.
What do you think of the efforts to land on asteroids and mine them?
You know, this could be a very complicated question. Obviously, if someone can make money on it, I'm all for it. If someone has a dream and wants to do it, I'm all for it. I'm an American in this concept. I don't want to stand in anybody's way to make something happen. And if there's investment capital that wants to pay for it, I'm all for it. And the resources on asteroids, most of those resources are probably going to be most valuable to future people living in space, though there are resources on asteroids that could be very valuable to here on Earth. But the problems that stand in the way of doing such things are political, because during the Cold War, the United States and the Soviet Union, communist nation, put together the Outer Space Treaty to try to establish rules for nations in space. And that treaty for a half century now has worked pretty well based upon how space exploration was being done by nations. But now that private enterprise is getting into the game very aggressively, that treaty causes a problem for private enterprise because it forbids any nation from claiming territory, which means no nation can establish its laws on any place it colonizes in space. So if an American private company wants to mine an asteroid or finds resources on the moon that they think are valuable, they cannot claim the territory. There can be no property rights. And so it's very difficult to get investment capital because you don't have a real firm hold on what you have, what you're mining. And so that's a problem. Mining in space is going to happen. It's either going to happen to provide needs that people living in space are going to need, or it's going to provide resources that we on Earth need. It might also be used for industrial. One of the things Jeff Bezos, the guy who runs Amazon, the reason he wants to go into space is he thinks the place to put really heavy industry is in space. Because if you have heavy industry in space, you've taken it off the Earth, and you protect the Earth where we live.
Interesting.
And there's something to be said for that. So his thinking is space will be a resource for building heavy industry for the Earth. That's a possibility.
Isn't that like 50, 100 years away?
It's very dangerous to make predictions on how fast things go. If it's private enterprise, it can happen really fast. That's what the United States proved in its history. We went from very poor, very minor colonies on the East Coast of North America in 1776, within less than 150 years, we were the world's most powerful, most wealthy, most successful nation on Earth. And that was because we valued the concepts of capitalism, freedom, and private enterprise, and private property. And so it can happen really, really fast. And in fact, we went 40 years where we couldn't get much accomplished because we were using a Soviet model of government program. And in just the last decade, we've started to transition away from that. And it's remarkable how much is beginning to happen so quickly. One of the things I like to point out to people is space shuttle missions did not generate much excitement for those 30 years they were happening. People would be interested, but there was very little generated excitement. If I wrote about it, people would not know anything about those flights when they happened. But every time SpaceX landed a first stage, it would be amazing to me how ordinary people would come up to me, not knowing what I do for a living, and say, "Hey, did you see that rocket land? Isn't it amazing what SpaceX is doing?" They were excited by it because it was private enterprise. Someone's following their dream, and that's cool, and that's exciting. And so, yes, this can happen very quickly. I think the UAE saying that they could have a colony on Mars in 100 years is recognizing that it is possible if you just simply go for it.
Now, don't you think somewhere along the line, some civilization is doing and has done to us what we want to do with out there? and that seed this planet and start it up. And maybe they came here and became the Earth colony.
I haven't the faintest idea, George.
I know you're not the UFO guy. That's for sure.
No. Well, yeah, I'm not. We've had this conversation. I mean,
many
I have no idea. It is, you know, I'll give you a story. China has a rover on the far side of the moon right now called U-22. Jade Rabbit is what that means in English, and it's been moving about on the far side, and after being up there for about 2 lunar days, it's traveled like 1,000 feet in the year it's been up there. But after about 2 months, the second lunar day was moving, they made a very cryptic announcement that they found in a small crater a very strange material. And I will not deny to you that the first thing I thought of was the monolith on 2000.
Yeah, exactly.
Odyssey. Because if an alien species wanted to set a monolith up to prove that we have reached a certain stage of development, putting it on the far side of the moon in a crater is not a bad idea. So the first thing, of course, it wasn't that. It was the material they saw was melted material from an impact, and it was just simply on the surface because it had been brought out from deep below the surface by the impact. So they were looking at material that came from deep within the lunar surface, from below the surface. And that's interesting. That's geologically really interesting. But I will admit that was the first thing. So I have no idea. I think the odds are slim to none that there were alien civilizations ahead of us on Earth. If such a thing had been found, we would have gotten the amount of research on geology and paleontology and archaeology that has gone on for the last 200 years to try to understand the history of the Earth geologically and in all other areas. If something was found that was reliable, we would know about it. The amount of prestige that would go to a scientist for such a discovery is so great.
Oh, huge.
That nobody would, it's not going to be kept secret. They're not going to want to keep it secret. Their payoff is too good. And they all want to find something like this if it could be. So I don't think that's the case. That having said that, that you can't prove a negative, so you can't prove, I can't prove that it's not the case. And so it's worth keeping your mind open. That's good science. But you don't keep your mind so open that your brains fall out. You have to think a little bit and take the reasonable course. I'll give you another example. We have now, for almost 100 years, not quite 100 years, have had radio technology, beaming, broadcasting, radio.
Mm-hmm, sure.
The planet, public broadcasting, radio broadcasting, which is a signal that goes out over the airwaves.
We're number one on Zeta Reticuli, by the way. Our ratings.
Okay.
Just so you know.
But the thing is that me and you, our voices are being broadcast on the radio. That signal spreads out beyond the Earth. And we've been doing it now for about 100 years. That's a sphere of 100-some-odd light years around the sun. In that sphere are a lot of stars. Now, the question then comes up, if there were alien species, at some point you would think they would detect that. We haven't gotten any responses, as far as I know. And on top of it, we have had now, since the late 60s, the SETI program, an attempt to detect signals from elsewhere. And you have astronomers looking across the entire electromagnetic band, looking at astronomy, but that means they're studying the entire electromagnetic band. If they got some really interesting if there was some alien species that was broadcasting Lucy, on their television, we would have seen it. If it happened a million years ago, it would have reached us. We'd get some detections. We haven't. That doesn't mean they don't exist out there. I'm not trying to say that. What I'm pointing out is that the data, right now, if anything, the data is suggesting, and this I also think is almost slim to none, but it's suggesting that we, the human race, might actually be within the Milky Way the first. Now, there's got to be a first. We don't think we're the first. It doesn't seem likely. There's too many planets that's been around.
Or the only. It's difficult to
be. We have to entertain the possibility.
Well, you know, a lot of people who are very ultra-religious think we're it.
Well, yeah, but I'm not speaking. Remember, I'm a facts guy. I'm a science journalist, a space historian. I'm not interested. I'm not talking here from a religious.
No, I know that.
And so, take it from that perspective. The data right now, you know, the data can change any minute. You know, in 2 seconds, we could make a discovery tomorrow that suddenly proves we're not the first. But the data right now is implying, because we've been, you know, once again, we're getting the technology that suggests we have the technology to have detected something. If there were multiple civilizations in the Milky Way, their radio signals should be scattered all over the place. You should start to pick something up. We haven't. Now, there is another possibility, and you know, this is all speculation. There's another possibility. On Earth itself now, we're beginning to transition from a broadcasting system to closed-circuit-type broadcasting, such as the Internet, which is not broadcast. You know, you get it through the line. You know, it's Wi-Fi, but that's very localized. It's not getting broadcast. Most of the time, it's on hardwire lines. And so, in a sense, we're going silent to the
outside. Well, that could happen. Robert, we're going to come back, talk more. I've got some more questions, and we'll open up the phone lines next.